I wonder, have you ever thought in your heart, in your mind, as you've met someone, seen someone, like spoken to someone, that the person that you've met or spoken to or have seen is beyond the hope of the gospel? Does that ever cross your mind? That you've seen their life and you've thought, really, there's no point witnessing to this person. They're hopeless. Well, perhaps you've never actually thought that way, but I feel fairly confident in saying that every one of us who is a Christian here this morning has acted that way. We have behaved that way. We have not bothered to witness to someone because we thought that the effort wasn't worthwhile. We couldn't see any possibility of any fruit from our efforts in the life of that particular person. I think had we had met Jacob early on in his life, he would have fallen into that category for us. Someone that was beyond the hope of the gospel. Someone who was so ingrained with sin and self-righteousness that he was beyond the effort that is necessary to share the gospel in the hope of producing fruit. The incident of chapter 27, where Jacob deceitfully pretends to be his older brother in order to get the blessing from his father Isaac that was reserved for the firstborn, is an illustration of this point. Now, admittedly, Jacob entered into this deceit on the encouragement of his mother. And we can perhaps forgive him somewhat for the steps that he took. But then nevertheless, it was his lips that spoke the lies, even to the extent of claiming that God had given him help in chasing down the game, in bringing in the meat for his father. It was outright blasphemy. Blasphemy that came from his own lips. Indeed, we could almost say that Rebekah herself could be excused for taking the action that she took. After all, the blessing did belong to Jacob and not to Esau. God himself had spoken to her and had told her that the younger would rule over the elder, that Jacob was God's chosen one through whom the promise of Abraham would be met. Rebekah remembered those things. Undoubtedly, Isaac also knew of those words spoken by God to Rebekah. But you see, Esau was his favorite. Esau was a man of the field. Esau was his favored son who could bring in choice game that would satisfy his stomach. And how often Isaac was led more by his stomach than by his mind. And so in the midst of all of these different aspects to this story, we nevertheless find that Jacob is a man who is willing to lean on his own resources, to go his own way, to depend on his own ingenuity. He was hardly the kind of person that we would think, well, there's a man that God can use. There's a man that God can bless If I witness to this person, they've got enormous potential. No, Jacob wasn't someone like that. And no doubt, most of us here this morning, had we been confronted by Jacob in those days, we would have just walked on by, giving him up as a hopeless case. But God didn't. And God did use Jacob. And God did bless Jacob. But it took a long time. And it took a great deal of effort. But God is a God who is patient. He has all the time in the world. And God is the God who is willing to work in the lives of those he chooses to save. Jacob is an illustration of that for us. And I just want to focus on three encounters with God that Jacob had during his lifetime. He had many more, but there's three of the main ones that I want us to just briefly consider this morning as we see the way that God gradually works in this self-sufficient man to make him a man of God, a man of faith. And the first incident we find in Genesis chapter 28, which was read to us earlier. In Genesis chapter 28, we have this famous story of Jacob's encounter with God in Bethel, that place which he named afterwards as the house of God. It's the story of Jacob's ladder, where in a dream at night, he saw a ladder set on the earth, and its top, we're told, reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. And there, lying on the ground in Bethel, Jacob was confronted with God. Jacob, the liar. Jacob, the blasphemer. Jacob, the supplanter, as his own name indicates, is met by God, who promises to be with him, who promises to bless him, who promises to fulfill in this man the covenant that he had made with Abraham, his ancestor. This Jacob, God meets with in this way. Why is that? We would have thought that at least God would have done some other work in this man's life first. That this Jacob would at least have begun to acknowledge God as God and not take matters into his own hands as he continues to do even after this incident. But here you see, in Bethel, God became real to Jacob. Perhaps for the very first time, Jacob realized God really does exist. That he really does act. That he really does intervene in the affairs of mankind. Oh, sure, he had heard the stories. He had known that Abraham had met with God on a number of occasions, that Abraham was called the friend of God, that Abraham had been so blessed by God. He knew all of that, no doubt about it. But until this time, he didn't know it himself. They were just stories to him. He had seen his own father's life, and he had seen how God had certainly blessed his father Isaac. But until now, the blessings that Jacob had come by his own wiliness and scheming. And here, as he sets out from home, and really his life begins, God meets him, and he effectively says to him, "Listen, Jacob, I am real. Listen, Jacob, you have to contend with me. This isn't just about you and how you can better those around you. It isn't just about you and how you can make your way in this world." God says to Jacob, "This is about me. It's about my choices. It's about my willingness to bless. It's about my strength to overcome the enemy. It is about my desire to do good to you and through you." And Jacob, we're told, awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." You see, that was the story of his life. God was there, and he didn't know it. But on this day, he learned the reality. God is here. He's here today. He's here every day. And he makes this vow to God. And he says, "If God will be with me," though some suggest that it ought to be translated, "since God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." Perhaps there is an element of doubt there yet. Perhaps Jacob is saying, "Well, if God does what he promises, then he will be my God." But there is room for the alternative that even at this point, Jacob understands the commitment God is making to him, and he makes this vow on the basis of an assurance that God will be with him. "Since God will be with me and keep me in this way, he will be my God. I will own him as my God." After all, as I've already said, he knew all the stories of God's greatness, of God's power. He just needed to know that God was real, that the stories weren't just stories. Or even that the stories weren't just for Abraham and Isaac, but that the stories were for him too, and that they were real to him too. Here on this occasion, he discovers the truth of God, the reality of God, and he is willing now to own God as his God, and not simply the God of Abraham and of Isaac. Now, he is the God of Jacob also. Jesus makes reference to this incident in John's Gospel, chapter 1. When he calls his first disciples, and we're told in verse 45 that Philip, who's already met Jesus, went and found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to him, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Philip said to him, come and see. Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit. Nathanael said to him, how do you know me? Jesus answered and said to him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said to him, because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, most assuredly I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. What Jesus is saying there is, I am the ladder to heaven. I am the gateway to heaven. Jacob in his dream had seen this ladder, and he had named the place the house of God, saying, this is the gate of heaven. But you don't need to go to Bethel in Palestine, somewhere between Paddan Aram and Hermon. You don't need to go there to find the gateway to heaven. No, you need to go to Jesus Christ. He is the one who gives you access into the presence of the living God. And Nathanael was being told there that what Nathanael would see in Jesus was heaven open, the blessing of God, the way of life. That Nathanael wouldn't just hear words of insight, that could only be divine revelation, but that Nathanael would see the way opened into the presence of God himself. Jacob had a glimpse of heaven on this particular day and was willing to call God his God. Nathanael met Jesus and said, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. And the question must arise, what are we doing with the God who has revealed himself to us in the pages of Scripture? Are they just stories to us? Does this book just contain a catalogue of morals for good living? Or do we see in the pages of Holy Scripture a ladder to heaven, a way to God in the person of Jesus Christ? Jacob encountered God in Bethel, and from that day on, he was willing to call God his God. But it was just the beginning. He had much to learn. We find another encounter with God further on in the story in chapter 32. Some 20 years have passed. 20 years in which Jacob has travelled to Paddan Aram. There he has met Laban. And Laban's daughter Rebekah, with whom he's fallen in love. He has agreed to serve Laban for 7 years to win the hand of Rebekah as his wife. He's tricked, something he knows well, but not to be the recipient of. And suddenly he's found his match. And he works another 7 years to win the girl of his love. And then he works another 6 years. And through all this time, God is dealing with Jacob. And through all this time, Jacob is learning the reality of his God. So that when he eventually does leave Laban, under cover of darkness, by stealth, he nevertheless acknowledges that his God has been with him and has blessed him. But we come to this encounter then in chapter 32 of Genesis, in a place initially called Mahanaim, which means basically two camps, because here, during his journey back from Paddan Aram to his father Isaac, he is met by angels. We're not told what this encounter involved. We're just told that Jacob went on his way and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." It was his camp. That was where he had chosen to spend the night. It was God's camp as well. He's acknowledging again the presence of God. But he was soon to rename this place Peniel, because he says, "I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved." This is the encounter that Jacob had with God in the flesh. It's the time when he wrestles with God all night. We're told that he was left alone on one side of the brook Jabbok, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And the man said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And the man said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." And Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you ask about my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." What's happening in this particular encounter of wrestling with this angel of God? Well, you see, so far in Jacob's life, Jacob has still depended on his own wit. He hasn't now stooped so low as to always take the quickest and the easiest route to blessing, which marked his life before his previous encounter with the living God. He has learnt great patience and perseverance, certainly, but he still relies on his own wit, his own intelligence. And in this incident, God teaches him that he needs to rest wholly on the living God to fulfill his purposes in his life. At Bethel, Jacob came to realize that God is real. At Peniel, Jacob came to realize that God was all. He sees his own resources are nothing. He has fought with this man all night long. How it all began, we're not told. And indeed, there's many questions that arise out of this passage that we don't have time to look at this morning. Nevertheless, confronted with the enormity of what lay before him the next day, his meeting with Esau, who he is told by his servants is accompanied by 400 men, Jacob's natural conclusion is that Esau is out to take revenge. And he's at his wit's end. He's done everything that he can think of that might be able to placate the wrath of Esau. He's divided his livestock into various groups and he sent them on one group at a time with the message to his servants to deliver these to Esau as a gift from him. And as these waves of gifts, enormous value, are delivered, he's hoping in this way somehow to assuage Esau's anger against him. But 20 years of anger, 20 years of brooding, 20 years of planning revenge, Jacob is sure will not be placated quite so easily. And God's encounter with him in Peniel confirms to Jacob that he is helpless, that he has met his match, that there is nothing he can do to come out of this one a winner. And he must rely on God. This man wrestles with him all night long, and as the daylight begins to break, he says to him, "Let me go." And Jacob says, "Oh, no way, I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me." See, Jacob has realized that this isn't some ordinary man that he's fighting with. While he asks his name later on in this passage, it isn't that he doesn't know who it is. And out of desperation, Jacob clings to this man and says, "I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me." This is a man who is beaten here. But he's just holding on. You can almost picture the scene of there is this angel of God trying to pull himself away, and there is this wreck of a man clinging to his ankle. He's done that once before. And that's all he can do, is cling to his ankle as this angel tries to pull away. "Let me go." Jacob says, "I'm not letting you go. It'll be the last thing I do before I die if I ever let you go, unless you bless me. Unless you deal with me. Unless you honor me. Unless you do for me what you have promised to do for me." Jacob's at the end of himself, and he realizes now that God is everything to him. And without God, he is nothing. God isn't just real. God is necessary for Jacob. And from this moment on, we see a radical change in the life of Jacob. Certainly he's not perfect, but all the scheming is gone from his life. And we see a dependence upon God and a willingness to submit to God that wasn't there previously. To live as a Christian is to live in dependence upon God. To live as a Christian is to say, "Not my will, but yours be done." To live as a Christian is to follow God's commands, even when we don't fully understand the implications of them. Even when it's confusing to us, even when we don't see how on earth things are going to turn out right, we trust in God, who has promised to bless us. We trust in God, who has promised never to leave us nor forsake us. We trust in the God who, through Jesus Christ, has opened heaven's doors for us and will take us home, though the road there be rocky and though the way be treacherous. God is dependable. And Jacob learns that lesson at Peniel. And so the next day, Jacob meets Esau. And to his amazement, Esau runs to meet him embraces him, falls on his neck, and kisses him. What a change has taken place between Esau and Jacob. Not that it will last for future generations, but God has dealt with Jacob. And God is blessing him. And God is answering his promise to protect him. And we see this in the outworking of this story. But I want to conclude as we see Jacob again encounter the living God. And it's an encounter that takes place a second time at Bethel, the house of God. It's recorded for us in Genesis chapter 35. God says to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother." And we're told that Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone." And so we're told in verse 9 of Genesis 35, God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. Also God said to him, "I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. The land which I have given Abraham and Isaac I give to you, and to your descendants after you I give this land." Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. Well, Jacob encounters God another time in Bethel, that place where he first learned that God was real, having also learned that God was necessary. He now confirms that there is no other God worth trusting. He buries all those idols that have been brought back from his uncle's house in Paddan Aram. He buries all the idols that have been gathered together during their sojourn in Shechem, a sojourn that has lasted some 10 years or so. All those things he puts away. He says to his family and to his servants, "Purify yourselves. Let us arise. Let us go up to the house of God, and I will make an altar there to God." Jacob is no longer the supplanter, no longer the deceiver, and God changes his name, or really confirms the change of his name, which actually took place in Peniel. And he is now called Prince with God, or one who has striven with God. The idea is that this is a man of God. No schemer anymore. No supplanter anymore. God, who first spoke those words to Rebekah and said that in Jacob would the promised seed come, here confirms it and blesses Jacob. And Jacob confirms there is no other God. He He's buried the past, and he focuses all now on worshipping the living God. Do we acknowledge God as God? Is he real to us? Is he necessary to us? Is he everything to us? Will we forsake all other things in order to live for this God, to honor this God, to serve this God? Will we live in the house of God, recognizing that wherever we are, God is with us, that we can never hide from God, we can never flee from God. God always sees, and we can see the face of God and live. Is God everything to you? You see, Jacob's changed, hasn't he? From the first time he came to Bethel, fleeing from a bloodthirsty Esau, in fear of his life, he comes back confident that God is with him. This should be true of every Christian. We ought to be able to look back over our lives and see a change. See progress, some measure of forward movement in our pilgrimage. It may be slow. It may be slight. But there must be some growth in grace. Some growth in holiness. Some difference from where we were 10, 20, 30 years ago. Are we growing? Or are we the same? Jacob was a changed man when he returned to Bethel. He loved God. He served God. He no longer relied on his own resources. Do you love God? Do you serve God? Oh, not perfectly. Jacob had many more things to learn in his life. He had still much growing to do. We're not talking about perfection here. But do you love God? And do you serve God? And can you see his hand at work in your life? Or may the Lord help us to learn from the life of Jacob, not only for ourselves, that we should look for growth ourselves, and that we should strive for a blessing from God, but also that we not give up on those around us, that we not think that they are beyond the scope of God's salvation. God can change the hardest of hearts. He can redeem the blackest of souls. This is the God we serve. This is the God we worship. May we see him work in our lives, in the lives of our loved ones, in the lives of our colleagues and neighbours, as we testify, as Jacob did, that this is our God and we will worship him.